From PRI, Public Radio International.
Granny Lynn tells old tales about flowers and grasses, and when she runs out of stories, she makes up new ones. After dinner, Granny Lynn leads Kang to the bathroom. She waits outside with a towel in his pajamas, and he sings in the shower the song about the red dragonfly she's taught him. Always, he shouts to Granny Lynn after the first 2 minutes, asking if he can come out now. She replies it would be good if he could stay in the shower for another 5 minutes. The boy goes on singing, his voice pure and perfect. Often, without turning off the water, Kang jumps out of the stall at Granny Lynn. She pretends to be startled and screams, and he giggles and runs off before she can wrap the towel around his dripping body. At night, as he sleeps, he mumbles in his dreams, his arms and legs thrown to all four directions on the blanket. Granny Lynn tucks him in and watches him for a long time, the unfamiliar warmth swelling inside her. She wonders if this is what people call falling in love, the desire to be with someone for every minute of the rest of her life so strong that sometimes she's frightened of herself.
That was Lois Smith reading a brief excerpt from the story Extra by Yi-Yun Lee, which we'll be hearing later in this program. This is Selected Shorts, a celebration of the short story. And I'm Isaiah Sheffer, Artistic Director of Symphony Space on Broadway and 95th Street on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, where Selected Shorts originates. This program contains two stories that each in its own way is about the art of parenting. The first is John Updike's story, Learn a Trade. It's a John Updike suburban story, which we read in the suburb of Westport in our presentation sponsored by the Westport Arts Center at the Westport Playhouse. John Updike needs no introduction to readers and listeners to Selected Shorts. Here's his story, Learn a Trade, read by Paul Hecht.
Mobiles, Fegley echoed over the telephone with a sinking feeling. He was an internationally known junk sculptor whose annual income ran well into six figures, but in his mind, he was still an unpopular and ill-coordinated adolescent walking out to a rural mailbox in Missouri to place in it a brown envelope containing cartoons and addressed to Colliers, or else to discover there a brown envelope returned from the same magazine with a rejection slip. Parch, Hoff, Ray, he imitated them all, and yet everything came back. Once he tried to sell the nearest city's only newspaper a comic strip, and then took the same cartoons to the local department store as the possible basis for an advertising scheme. His mother went with him into the city that day, since he was too young to drive. And a street photographer snapped a picture of them walking together, she clutching her purse, he holding his portfolio under a skinny arm, both of them looking distracted and tired. His mother had sponsored his creativity, indulged it. Almost his first memory of her was of a young woman sitting on the threadbare carpet with him, crayoning solid a space at the top of a page of the coloring book on the floor before her. It seemed marvelous to the child that she, sitting opposite him, could color upside down, as well as with such even, gentle strokes which never strayed outside the printed outlines. Fegley's father, who supplemented the income from the farm by working as a non-union carpenter, wrung his hands to think of his son wasting his life on hopeless ambitions. Learn a trade, he begged the boy. Get a solid trade, and then you can fool around with this artsy, craftsy stuff. One night in bed, Fegley, shortly before going off to New York art school, overheard his father confide to his mother downstairs. They'll just break his heart. Overhearing this, The boy had inwardly scoffed, and, eventually moving from cartooning by way of imitating the playful sculpture of Picasso and Ipostigi into a world of galleries and spacious duplexes and expectant museum spaces that his father had never dreamed existed, he proved the old man wrong. Yet, the older that Fegley himself grew, the more it seemed his father had been essentially right. In the pattern of his generation, he had married young, had four children, and eventually got a divorce. His first wife, met at the art school, had been herself artistic. Sarah painted delicate, impressionistic still lifes and landscapes that were often abandoned before the corners were filled. There was usually something wrong with the perspective, though the colors were remarkably true. He sometimes blamed himself in their years together for not encouraging her more, but in truth, all this artsy-craftsy stuff depressed him. And he hoped that his children would become scientists. He plied the two boys, especially with telescopes and microscopes, chemistry sets, and books of mathematical puzzles. They squinted at Saturn's rings for an evening and at magnified salt granules for an afternoon, and then the expensive tubes of brass and chrome drifted toward the closets, already full of deflated footballs and gadgets whose batteries had given out. Fegley's two daughters, as they grew into women, with the distances and silences of women, took watercolor brushes and pads on their sunbathing expeditions, and at home solemnly inscribed haiku on pebble board with crow quill pens. Their mother encouraged all this, having set the example by her own dabbling, which fitfully continued into her middle age. The house was strewn with Sarah's half-completed canvases. Fegley did his powerful, successful sculptures, most famously the series of giant burnished insects fabricated from discarded engine blocks and transmission systems, in an old machine shop he rented 2 miles from the house, down low along the Hudson. He did not encourage his children to visit him there, and even had his subscription to Art News directed to that address. He was like a man who, having miraculously survived a shipwreck, wants to warn all others back at the edge of the sea. As the two boys grew older, he congratulated himself that they seemed more concerned with putting their feet to leather balls and car accelerators than with setting implements to paper. Unlike his youthful self, they were popular and well-coordinated and expert at sports. The older went off to college, determined to make the football varsity, having been a spectacular shifty tight end for his boarding school. But somewhere, under the cloud of his parents' divorce proceedings, he dropped out of athletics and into film studies. He took courses, college courses for credit, that analyzed the cutting rhythm in old Laurel and Hardy comedies and the advance of camera mobility in musical comedies of the 40s. Now he was living in a squalid Manhattan loft with several other aspirants to the world of film. Lost young souls stoned on media, pounding the sidewalks, and virtually, who knows, maybe actually selling their bodies for the whisper of a promise of becoming an assistant grips assistant in a public television documentary on the African killer bee. Fegley's daughters had also faded into the limbo of artistic endeavor. One was in Northern California making pinch pots out of her lover's backyard clay, and the other was editing a journal of genealogy in Cincinnati while working on a highly ambitious feminist novel called Ever Since Eve. This left, uncontaminated by creativity, only the younger son, Warren. Warren was a broad-shouldered, brown-eyed 19-year-old who had once collected butterflies and rock specimens and who was clever with his hands. He had even given signs of becoming a carpenter, working alongside his grandfather for a few summers before the old man died. Here, at last, Fegley had thought, was my practical, down-to-earth child. So it was with a sinking feeling that Fegley heard that the boy was making mobiles this summer. But what about his job? He asked. I don't think he ever called that number Clara gave him, Sarah said. Clara, Fegley's present wife, was a civil engineer with a firm in White Plains and had given her stepson a lead on a summer job with a road repair crew. What do you mean exactly, mobiles? Fegley asked. Oh, they're lovely, the distant voice answered. They really must be seen to be believed. You should come look. Her voice was fading. One of her annoying habits, which he had not been much aware of as long as they lived together, was that of dropping the telephone mouthpiece to her chin as she talked. All right, damn it, I'll be right over, Fegley said. I want to talk to Warren. Clara went to a lot of trouble to find a contractor who had filled his minority quota. He left his new studio, an abandoned gas station in Portchester with its friendly mounds of junk and pleasant unifying stench of the acetylene torch, and swung his Porsche up onto the battered road into that over-trafficked grid interconnecting Westchester County's hidden green hives of plenty. He drove the 30 minutes across 287 to his old suburb. It was strange to be in his former home. The large Tarrytown house, once so full of children and their music and clutter, was silent now, and its furniture only half familiar. The former Mrs. Fegley had a new husband, a hearty pipe smoker whose spoor and scent were everywhere. Like Clara, the man led a useful, inartistic life and worked all day. Sarah still painted, and what was hurtful had improved. Her still lifes were filled to the corners, and the perspective was tight as a drum. Apologetically, she announced, Warren said he'd be right back. I told him you were coming. Where did he go, ostensibly? He said downtown to buy some more copper wire. His mobiles take a lot of it. I bet. Do you know what copper wire costs these days? Of course. Who do you think gives him the money? Then why do you let him? I let you, she said, and looked lightly away, the equivalent of allowing the telephone mouthpiece to slip down to her chin. It was true. She had let him do what he could. She had indulged him. For a time, she had supported them both, working as a salesgirl in the old Fifth Avenue Bonwits. Sarah had put on weight without impairing a certain absent-minded grace that flitted into the air from foci in her wrists and ankles. Adjusted to the sight of her and the ambiance of the house, Fegley remembered the kindergarten crayon scrawls posted on the refrigerator with magnets, the driftwood sculptures brought home from their summer rentals, the collages of beach glass, the crow-quilled haiku, the linoleum cuts at Christmas time, the cardboard circuses. Once, Fegley had bought the children a set of Cuisenaire rods to inculcate number theory, and the baby daughter, then about 4 years old, had taken two of the units for number one, tiny wooden cubes, and penciled dots on them to make dice. She had made little cats of the rectangular rods representing number two, dogs of the longer threes, people with faces and bow ties of the still longer fours, and skyscrapers with penciled windows and canopied doorways of the fives. Sarah had gone ecstatic over this show of creativity. The child, Fegley saw now, should have been spanked. A delayed fury spoke in him. You've brought these kids up to live in a never-never land. All this stuff the world doesn't need. It needs practical nurses. It needs securities analysts. You should tell them. I never told you, she said in that same mild and distant voice. Why should I say it to them? I was different, he said. I was ignorant. I was desperate to get out of Missouri. Our children aren't desperate. They're just kidding around. Sarah shrugged. Who's to say? He's been so excited. I've never seen him work this hard down in the cellar all day and into the night, pounding and sawing. Fegley's father's hands, he remembered, had combined the hardened traces of chisel nicks and saw slips with a spotty bubbling of brown warts on the backs. Those hands had done honest work, Fegley used to think, admiring them. And now his own hands, scarred by metal, looked much the same. The image of his broad-shouldered son in the cellar, captive to an illusion, and of a once young and slender woman standing on sore feet behind a counter at Bonwitz, and of his own young mother sitting opposite him, carefully crayoning in the depths of the Depression. These superimposed images afflicted him with a pathos and sense of waste that were paralyzing. His former wife had to prompt, "Why don't you go down and look at them?" I don't want to see the damn things. I came to see him. It might be a while before he comes back, frankly. I think he was scared of what you'd say to him. That's why he took off. Warren had inherited his brown eyes from her with those same elusive golden flecks. Ah, poor little Warren, Fegley said, and descended the steps to his former cellar. Scrap lumber and stray junk from the long ago when he had worked at home had mysteriously disappeared. His old workbench supported an unfamiliar litter of pliers and snippers, coiled wire, cut tin, glue, tape, and mutilated sheets of plastic and cardboard. A new fluorescent tube brightened the workspace, but Warren had hung the finished mobiles in the dimness that stretched beneath the cobwebbed pipes and floor stringers to the faint, far stone foundation wall. Each mobile embodied a different idea. Some suggested the flight of birds, others the scales of a dragon. Some were twirled of copper wire into terminations like the heads of fiddlehead ferns, and some held at the ends of invisible black wire arms, cardboard paddle shapes or crescents or circles, ranged in sequences drifting outward in precarious spacey cascades that gently moved as the creator's mother's footsteps, heavy with fatality, descended the stairs.
See?
Sarah asked. Each mobile, by itself, might have looked spindly, but the effect of so many, hanging unsold, unrequested by the world, waiting here in the dark, was of a leafy forest or a firmament of stars twinkling one behind the other in a recession as good as infinite. Yeah, Fegley had to say half to himself. His former wife came and stood beside him to get the same perspective. That's right, he said. Keep breaking my heart.
Paul Hecht read John Updike's story, Learn a Trade. You can find out more about the authors and actors on this program at our website, selectedshorts.org. After a break, we'll be coming back with a story by Yi-Yun Lee, read by Lois Smith. You are listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide, from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts, recorded live at Symphony Space in New York City. Symphony Space's season is sponsored by Zabar's, offering the nation a taste of New York. Coffee, gourmet foods, and gift baskets available online at zabars.com. Our next story is from an evening hosted at Symphony Space by Jane Fonda and devoted to the women authors of Random House. The author is Yiyun Li, who was born in Beijing, attended Peking University, and now lives in America. The name of the story is Extra, and the reader is that extraordinary actress, Lois Smith.
Granny Lin walks in the street on a November afternoon with a stainless steel lunch pail in her hand. Inside the lunch pail is an official certificate from her working unit. Hereby, we confirm Comrade Lin Mei is honorably retired from Beijing Red Star Garment Factory, says the certificate in bright golden characters. It does not say that Red Star Garment Factory has gone bankrupt or that being honorably retired, Granny Lin will not receive her pension. Of course, it will not provide such information, for these facts are simply not true. Bankrupt is the wrong word for a state-owned industry. Internal reorganization is what has been kindly omitted in the certificate. And, mind this, Granny Lin's pension is being withheld only temporarily. For how long? The factory has no further information to offer. There is always a road when you get into the mountain, Auntie Wang, Granny Lin's neighbor, says to her upon being informed of Granny Lin's situation. And there is a Toyota wherever there is a road. The second line of Toyota's commercial slips out before Granny realizes it. There you go, Granny Lin. I know you are an optimistic person. Stay positive. You will find your Toyota. But where on earth can she find a way to replenish her dwindling savings? For a few days, Granny Lin adds, subtracts, and divides, and she decides that her savings will run out in a year, in 2 years, if she can skip a meal here and there, go to bed right after sunset, and stay bundled up so that she does not have to feed the insatiable stove extra coal balls through the long winter of northern China. Don't worry, Auntie Wang says the next time they meet each other at the market, looking down at the single radish Granny Lin has bought for her dinner, as plump as a Buddha, dwelling between her two palms. You can always find someone and get married. Get married, Granny Lin says, and blushes. Don't be so conservative, Granny Lin, Auntie Wang says. How old are you? 51. You are even younger than I am. I am 58, but I'm not as old-fashioned as you. You know what? Young people no longer have a monopoly on marriage. Don't make me a clown, Granny Lin says. I am serious. Granny Lin, there are so many old widowers in the city, I am sure there are rich and sick ones who need someone to take care of them. You mean I can find a caretaker's position for old people? Granny Lin asks. Auntie Wang sighs and pokes Granny Lin's forehead with a finger. Use your brain, not a caretaker, but a wife. That way you can at least inherit some cash when your husband dies. Granny Lin gasps. She has never had a husband in her life, and the prospect of a dead husband frightens her. Yet Annie Wang makes the decision for her right there and then, between two fish stands, and in a short time, she finds Granny Lin a match. 76, high blood pressure and diabetes, wife just died, living alone in a three-bedroom flat, pension 2,000 yuan a month, both sons married and earning good money in the government, Auntie Wang says, surprised that Granny Lin remains unimpressed. Come on, Granny Lin. Where else can you find such a good husband? The old man will die in no time, and the sons are so rich they won't mind sparing some of the old man's savings for you. Their doorsill has been worn away by the feet of the matchmakers, but of all the possible wives, they are interested only in you. Why? Because you are never married and you have no children. By the way, Granny Lin, how come you aren't married? You never told us the reason. Granny Lin opens and then closes her mouth. It just happens, she says. You don't have to tell me if you don't want to. Anyway, they don't want someone who has a litter of children and grandchildren. I wouldn't trust such a stepmother either, who can guarantee she won't steal from the old man for her children. But you are the best. I have told them that. Were there one honest person left on earth, it would be you, Granny Lin. What are you hesitating for? Why don't they hire someone to take care of him? Granny Lin asks. thinking of the two sons who might soon become her stepchildren. Won't it be cheaper in the long run? Do you not know what those young girls from the nanny market are like? They are lazy and they steal money, husbands too, if they are hired by young couples. They leave the old people sitting in their own shit all day long to hire such a girl. Ugh, it would only push him to death quicker. Granny Lynn has to agree that, indeed, an older woman as a wife is a wise choice. Accompanied by Auntie Wang, Granny Lynn goes to the interview with the two sons and their wives. An hour of questioning later, the two sons exchange a look and ask if Granny Lynn needs some time to consider the marriage offer. Not having much to think about, she moves into her new home in a week. Her husband, Old Tang, is sicker than she has thought. Alzheimer's. A daughter-in-law tells her at their wedding dinner. Granny Lynn nods, not knowing what the disease is, but guessing it has something to do with the brain. She supports her husband with both hands and leads him to the table, sitting him down and wiping away the drool from his chin. Granny Lynn becomes a wife, a mother, and a grandmother. She no longer remembers in what year of her life people started to call her Granny Lynn instead of Auntie Lynn. Unmarried women, people believe, age faster, but it does not matter anymore because she feels quite qualified for her name. Every week, one of the sons stops by and checks on Old Tang, leaving enough money for the next week. Old Tang is a quiet man, sitting in his chair by the window, immersed in his bottomless silence. Once in a while, he asks Granny Lynn about his wife, and as instructed by the two sons, Granny Lynn replies that the wife is improving in the hospital and will be home in no time. But before she replies, Old Tang seems to have forgotten his question and goes back to his meditation without any sign of having heard Granny Lynn. She waits for more questions that never come and eventually gives up. She turns up the volume of the television and shuffles around the house, sweeping and dusting and wiping and washing. But the time arrives earlier each day when she finishes the housework. Then she sits down on the couch and watches the daytime soap operas. Unlike the 12-inch television Granny Lynn used to own, which required her to make a trip across the room every time she needed to change channels, and altogether, she got 6 channels through the antenna made of 2 steel chopsticks. Old Tang's set is a monster with scores of channels which all obey a small remote control. Dazed by all the choices she has and by the ease of moving from one selection to another, Granny Lynn soon finds that the machine does her no good, no matter what program she's watching. There's always the nagging worry that she is missing a more interesting one. Several days into her new life, Granny Lynn is stunned to discover that she is no longer addicted to television as she has been in the past 10 years. Does marriage have such revolutionary power that a long-established habit can be overthrown in such a short time? Granny Lynn sighs and clicks off the television. Old Tang does not notice the silence flooding the room. She realizes then that the television is not to blame. It is because of Old Tang's presence that she cannot focus. She picks up an old magazine and peeks at Old Tang from behind the pages. 10 minutes grows into 20 minutes. She continues looking at him as he insists on not meeting her gaze. She has an odd suspicion that Old Tang is not ill. He knows she is there, and he is observing her secretly. He knows that his wife of 54 years has left him for good and that Granny Lynn is his new wife, but he refuses to acknowledge her. He pretends to have lost his mind and expects her to play along as if she were a hired caretaker, but Granny Lynn decides not to concede. He is her husband. She is his wife. Their marriage certificate is secure under her pillow. If Old Tang is testing her patience, she is ready to prove it to him. It is a tug of war that Granny Lynn is determined to win. She puts down the magazine and looks boldly into Old Tang's face, trying to outstare Old Tang. Minutes stretch into an hour, and all of a sudden, Granny Lynn awakens in a dread that she too is losing her mind. She drags her body out of the couch and stretches, feeling the small cracking of her arthritic joints. She looks down at Old Tang, and he is still a statue. Indeed, he is a sick man, she thinks. and feels the shame of having cast ruthless doubt on old Tang, a man as defenseless as a newborn baby. She walks to the kitchen quickly and comes back with a glass of milk. Milk time, she says, patting old Tang's cheek until he starts to swallow. 3 times a day, Granny Lin gives old Tang an insulin shot. Only then does she catch a glimpse of the life left in old Tang, the small flinch of the muscle when she pushes the needle into his arm. Sometimes a small bead of blood appears after she draws the needle out, and she wipes it away with her fingertip instead of a cotton ball, entranced by the strange sensation that his blood is seeping into her body. Several times a day, Granny Lin bathes old Tang in the morning and before bedtime, and whenever he wets or dirties himself. The private bathroom is what Granny Lin likes best about her marriage. For all her life, she has used public bathrooms, fighting with other slippery bodies for the lukewarm water drizzling from the rusty showers. Now that she has a bathroom all to herself, she never misses any chance to use it. Old Tang is the only man that Granny Lin has seen in full nakedness. The first time she undressed him, she could not help stealing a look now and then at the penis nestled in a thinning bush. She wondered what it had looked like in its younger years, but right away chased the unclean thought from her mind. The frail nakedness filled her heart with a tenderness she had never experienced, and she has since tended his body with motherly hands. One evening in late February, Granny Lin leads old Tang to the plastic chair in the middle of the bathroom. She unbuttons his pajamas and he bends his arms at her guidance, his head leaning on her shoulder blade. She removes the nozzle and sprays warm water on his body, putting one hand on his forehead so that the water does not get into his eyes. Granny Lin is squatting on the floor and massaging old Tang's legs when he touches her shoulder with his palm. She looks up, and he is gazing into her eyes. She gives out a cry and backs away from him. "Who are you?" old Tang says. "Old Tang," Granny Lin says, "is it you?" "Who are you? Why are you here?" "I live here," Granny Lin says. She sees an unnatural lucidity in old Tang's eyes and feels her heart fall. Such a moment of clarity happens only before a nearing death. Granny Lin had seen the same light 2 years earlier in her father's eyes, hours before he passed away. She thinks of rushing out to call a doctor, but her feet are locked on the floor, and her eyes are locked in his eyes. "I don't know you. Who are you?" Granny Lin looks down on herself. She's wearing a bright yellow plastic poncho and a pair of grass-green rubber boots, her outfit for bath time. "I am your wife," she says. "You are not my wife. My wife is Sue Jane. Where is Sue Jane?" "Sue Jane is no longer with us. I'm your new wife." "You're lying," old Tang says and stands up. "Sue Jane is in the hospital." "No," Granny Lin says. "They lied to you." Old Tang does not hear her. He pushes Granny Lin, and his arms are suddenly strong. Granny Lin clutches him, but he's wild and uncontrollable with force. She lets go of his hands, not knowing why she needs to fight with her husband over a dead woman. But he is still wrestling with the air, and 2 steps away, slips down in a puddle of soapy water. Nobody pays attention to Granny Lin at the funeral. She sits in a corner and listens to the men and women who come up to talk about old Tang's life. An accomplished physicist and a great teacher. A loving husband, father, and grandfather. The speakers finish and shake the family members' hands, ignoring her at the end of the line. "I did not kill him," Granny Lin imagines herself telling every person there. "He was dying before the fall." But she does not tell the truth to anyone and instead admits her negligence. Nobody would believe her anyway, for she alone saw the light in his eyes, the last glimmer before the eternal night, as it is called, the brief moment of lucidity before the end. Granny Lynn does not get a penny from Old Tang's savings. She has looked after Old Tang for only 2 months and has in many of the relatives' minds killed him with her carelessness. She does not blame the two sons. She can think only of their loss, 1,000 times more painful than her own. And when one of them suggests a job in a private boarding school that is run by his friend, Granny Lynn almost weeps out of gratitude. Situated in a mountain resort in a western suburb of Beijing, Mei Mei Academy takes pride in being among the first private schools in the country. It occupies one of the few four-storied buildings that were allowed to be constructed in the area. Connections, connections, the chef tells Granny Lynn the day she arrives. How else could the school have gained the permit if not for its powerful trustees? Private schools, like all private businesses, are sprouting up across the country like bamboo shoots after the first spring rain. Relatives of the Communist Party leaders are being transformed overnight into business owners, their faces appearing on national TV as representatives of the new proletariat entrepreneurs. Granny Lynn cannot imagine a better life now that she has become a maid at the academy. Every meal is a banquet. Meat and fish are abundant. Vegetables are greener than Granny Lynn remembers them from her market days. Everything is produced by a small organic farm that serves the president and the premier and their families, so the chef informs Granny Lynn. Sometimes Granny Lynn feels sad at seeing so much good food go into the garbage. She begins to come late to her meals, waiting until the students finish theirs. Throughout the dining hall, untouched vegetables are left withering on the plates. Shipwrecked fishes lie flat on their half-gnawed bellies. Granny Lynn spoons the leftovers onto her plate and dreams of having an express shuttle running between the school and the city every day, taking the unconsumed food to her old neighbors. Eating such good food without working hard is a sin. In addition to the laundry and dorm cleaning assigned to her, Granny Lynn takes on other duties. She gets up early in the morning and opens the classroom windows to let in fresh mountain air. She sweeps and mops the terrazzo floor. She dusts and wipes the students' desks. She makes sure everything is meticulous, even though the janitor has cleaned the classrooms the night before. Sometimes, when there's still time before the wake-up bell, she leaves the school and takes a walk in the mountains. The morning fog is damp on her skin and her hair, and birds she has never seen in the city sing in a chorus. At such moments, Granny Lynn feels overwhelmed by her good fortune. The years in the factory seem a distant dream now, and she no longer remembers what her life was like when she walked through the morning smog, expelled by the coal stoves, and bargained in the market for vegetables puffed up by chemical fertilizers. Often Granny Lynn gathers an armful of wildflowers on her walk, mountain orchids, pearl cherries, jade barrettes. She arranges the flowers in vases for the 6 classrooms, one for each grade, but such a delicacy rarely lasts beyond the first period. Boys of all ages pelt one another with the flowers. The boy whose lips touch the flowers is called a sissy. Girls of the upper grades pull the petals off, bury them in a mound in the schoolyard. Their fingers ruthless, and their faces shrouded with a sad seriousness. The school is growing. Every month a few new students arrive. Granny Lynn is stunned by the parents' wealth, the ease with which they pay the initiation fee of 20,000 yuan and another 20,000 for the first year of tuition and room and board. In the 3rd month of Granny Lynn's stay, the school celebrates its 100th student with a feast. Kang, the boy who draws the lucky number, is 6 years old. Unlike the other students who come from the city, he was sent from a nearby province. A few days into his stay, the teachers and the staff members have all heard his story. Kang's grandfather used to be the leader of a big people's commune in his home province, and his father has become one of the top agricultural entrepreneurs in northern China. "I thought fathers liked to keep their sons at home," Granny Lynn says to Mrs. Du, a dorm mother, as they search for the foul-smelling socks under the mattresses. "They can almost stand up and walk by themselves," is how Mrs. Du describes the stiff socks that have been worn for too long. "Not when he is the son of a disfavored wife," Mrs. Du says. "An extra is what he is." Are the parents divorced? Who knows, but the father does have another wife or a concubine. What's the difference? The boy's mother is no longer needed in the family, and the child has to go too. The thought of the boy, who is so small and occupies almost no space at all in the world, yet who is still in other people's way and has to be got rid of, saddens Granny Lynn. She starts to look for the boy among the crowd. His clothes of the same brand names as those that the other students wear look wrong on him. Too large, too new, too trendy. The clothes do not belong to him any more than he belongs to the school. His face and hands always seem in need of a thorough wash, but after Granny Lynn herself has tended to them several times, she has to agree it is not the child's or the dorm mother's fault. In the second week, Kang starts to come to the laundry room during the afternoon activity time. "Granny, what's this?" he asks one day while Granny Lynn is massaging some baby lotion into his cheeks. "Something that will make you into a city boy," Granny Lynn says. "Granny, where do you live?" "I live here." "But before you came here, where is your husband's home?" Granny Lynn thinks for a moment. "In the city," she says. "What's the city like? My mom said she'd take me to see the city." "Where is your mom?" Granny Lynn asks, holding her breath and trying to make her heart beat less loudly. The boy seems not to notice. "She is at home." "Your father's home?" "My grandfather's home. My new mom lives in my father's home." "What's your new mom like? Is she pretty?" "Yes." "Is she good to you?" "Yes." "Do you like her?" "Yes." "Do you like your mom also more than your new mom?" Granny Lynn asks. She turns around to see whether anyone is walking past the laundry room in the hallway. She feels like a thief. The boy, too, turns around nervously. He then comes closer and circles his arms around Granny Lynn's neck, his mouth to Granny Lynn's ear, his hot breath touching her earlobe. "Granny, I'll tell you a secret. Don't tell anyone." "I won't. My mom said she would come and get me back one day." "When?" "She said soon." "When did she say it?" "Before my new mom moved in." "And when was that?" "Last year." "Have you seen your mom since then?" "No, but she said she'd come soon if I don't make my dad and my new mom angry," Kang says. "Granny, do you think the guards will let her in when she comes?" "I'm sure they will," Granny Lynn says. The boy smells like a mixture of baby lotion, fresh laundry, and clean sweat. It reminds Granny Lynn of old Tang after his bath, the way a dear person smells good. The thought makes Granny Lynn's lips go dry, and she feels the boy's arms on her neck, hot and sticky. On Friday afternoons, the parking lot outside the school gate is full of luxury cars. Chauffeurs and nannies come, and sometimes the parents themselves show up. Teachers and dorm mothers stand inside the gate, pointing out to one another who is the daughter-in-law of a power figure in the government and who has appeared in the latest hit movie. Kang is the only child who stays for the weekend. His father has paid the extra fee for the weekend care and has promised to come for him at the end of the semester. Sometimes Granny Lynn wonders if the father will ever come and what will become of Kang if no one picks him up when summer comes. Will he be able to stay with her at the school? And then she wonders if she herself will be allowed to stay and if not, where she will spend the 2 months before she's allowed back in September. After the last student is picked up every weekend, the teachers and the dorm mothers leave on a shuttle bus for the city. Apart from the two guards, Granny Lynn is the only one who stays, and she has cheerfully agreed to take care of Kang. They stand side by side at the school gate and wave at the bus, and both sigh with relief once it is gone. Kang darts across the yard to the activity room, flipping through the picture books as fast as he can, eager to get to the next one. Granny Lynn comes in and sits down at his side, stroking his hair and watching him laugh to himself. When he finishes all the new books, they go out together and play in the yard, Granny Lynn pushing him in the swing until he's flying so high that Kang screams with excitement and fear. When the weather is nice, they take long walks in the mountains. Weekend tourists swarm into the area, but Granny Lynn and Kang are the only two people who do not worry about missing the bus or getting stuck in a traffic jam. They walk hand in hand. Kang's palm touching Granny Lin's palm, both sweating. Granny Lin tells old tales about flowers and grasses, and when she runs out of stories, she makes up new ones. After dinner, Granny Lin leads Kang to the bathroom. She waits outside with a towel in his pajamas, and he sings in the shower the song about the red dragonfly she's taught him. Always, he shouts to Granny Lin after the first 2 minutes, asking if he can come out now. She replies it would be good if he could stay in the shower for another 5 minutes. The boy goes on singing, his voice pure and perfect. Often, without turning off the water, Kang jumps out of the stall at Granny Lin. She pretends to be startled and screams, and he giggles and runs off before she can wrap the towel around his dripping body. At night, as he sleeps, he mumbles in his dreams, his arms and legs thrown to all four directions on the blanket. Granny Lin tucks him in and watches him for a long time. The unfamiliar warmth swelling inside her. She wonders if this is what people call falling in love. The desire to be with someone for every minute of the rest of her life so strong that sometimes she's frightened of herself. Granny Lin is not the first person to have noticed the missing socks. The dorm mothers for 2 weeks in a row tell her that the girls are complaining that their favorite socks are disappearing in the laundry. Granny Lin knows then what has happened to the socks. A few times she's seen Kang clutch a girl's unwashed sock. He drops it into the basket when he realizes that she's watching him. The next weekend, while Kang is playing a computer game in the activity room, Granny Lin searches his bed. She finds nothing under the mattress where the kids usually hide things. She folds back the blanket, she picks up the pillow, and unzips the pillowcase and sees 5 socks inside rolled up into small bundles, like newborn bunnies. Granny Lin unrolls them, young girl socks, with flowered patterns or cartoon animals. She thinks of putting them in her own pocket, but stops at the thought of Kang groping in the pillowcase for the socks. Something dear to him for reasons she does not know. She rolls the socks back up and stuffs them into the pillowcase. On Monday, Granny Lin asks her supervisor for a half day off and takes the bus to the city looking for socks with the same patterns as the missing ones. She buys several more packs of girls' socks in different designs. Granny Lin becomes more careful with the laundry now. She makes sure all the girls' socks are in their bags before Kang arrives. From time to time, she scatters around socks that she's bought, all of them having been washed and dried and then rubbed across the floor. They are still the happy couple on weekends, but Granny Lin worries as she counts the missing socks that she's put out for Kang. She wonders if she needs to talk to him and find out the reason for what he is doing. But every time she opens her mouth, she loses her resolve. On weekends, as they sit in the shadow of the wisteria, Granny Lin wonders if this is the love she missed in her younger years, hand in hand with a dear boy, not asking him to tell her the secret she's not allowed to know. The weather gets hot, and the dorm mothers put mosquito nets over the students' beds. The first night, a boy in the bed next to Kang's gets up after the dorm mother leaves. With a small flashlight in hand, he sticks his head into Kang's mosquito net and shrieks in a low voice, letting the flashlight shine in Kang's eyes. Kang does not cry, as the boy hopes. But the boy is surprised and pleased to find Kang stroking his own cheeks with both his hands in floral socks. Dorm mothers are called. 7 more socks are discovered. And by the end of the next day, everyone in the school knows about the sick boy who steals girls' socks and does strange things with them. Granny Lin watches the kids chase Kang around the schoolyard, calling him sicko, psycho, porn boy. Her heart wrenching as if it were a piece of rag in the washing machine. Kang is no longer allowed to visit the laundry room. She counts the days to the weekend and is afraid that she will break down before the 3 days pass. On Friday afternoon, as they stand in front of the school gate, Granny Lin has to raise Kang's hand up and wave for him. When the shuttle bus is gone, Granny Lin turns to Kang, who is kicking a pebble in front of him. Kang, come to Granny's room for a moment, Granny Lin says. No, I don't want to, Kang says, letting go of Granny Lin's hand. What do you want to do? Let's take a walk. I don't want to take a walk. How about reading some books? A new case of books came in yesterday. I don't want to read. Let's get up on the swing. I don't want to do anything, Kang says, pushing Granny Lin's hand away from his shoulder. Granny Lin's tears swell out of her eyes. She looks down at the top of Kang's head. To love someone is to want to please him, even when one is not able to. Think of something you want to do and we'll do it together. Think of something you want. And Granny will get it for you. You know Granny loves you. I want to go home. I want to see my mom, Kang says. Granny, do you think we can catch the train and go home for 2 days? Granny Lin looks down at Kang's upturned face, seeing the small hope grow bigger in his eyes. Kang grabs her hand. Granny, just 2 days. Nobody will know. Granny Lin sighs. Forgive me, Kang, but Granny cannot do this for you. But why? You said you'd do anything. Anything that we can do here, in the school, in the mountains. Kang, good boy, we cannot leave the school. It takes a minute for Kang to burst into tears. Granny Lin tries to quiet him and pull him into her arms. Kang pushes her away, and his eyes, with the cold anger that Granny Lin once saw in old Tang's eyes, chill her. Kang runs across the schoolyard. Granny Lin runs after him, but has to stop and catch her breath after a few steps. Her old body is failing her young heart. Granny Lin thought that Kang would be crying in his bed, but the boy's not there. She calls out his name as she walks in the building, checking each unlocked door, the activity room, the music room, the dining hall. She looks under tables, behind curtains, and her heart sinks deeper each time her hope proves unfounded. For an hour, Granny Lin searches until it occurs to her that the boy may have left the building and even the school. Paralyzed by such a thought and imagining all kinds of disasters, she calls the two guards who are playing poker in the small room by the school gate. Neither wants to admit the possibility that the boy is squeezed through the gate, both insisting that the boy must be hiding somewhere in the building. More searches are carried out by the three of them. When nothing is yielded, they each start to panic with different worries. The police are called. The school supervisor is called. The dorm mothers are called. The guards make phone calls to whomever they can think of. Granny Lin watches one of the young men punch the number with a shaking hand and wonders why he is so nervous. The guards are only losing a peaceful weekend. They will lose at most a month's salary, as both are relatives of the trustees. Boys disappear every day. What would they remember of Kang a year from now, even if they never found him again? Granny Lin begins to cry. But Kang shows up by himself in the middle of the turmoil, unharmed, hungry, sleepy. He must have played hide-and-seek with Granny Lin while she was looking for him. Or did he want to punish her for disappointing him? Granny Lin does not know. All she knows is what he told the school supervisor, that he fell asleep under the piano. Granny Lin remembers looking under the piano, but nobody trusts an old woman's memory. Besides, what's the difference, even if she is telling the truth? She has proved herself incapable. More stories are remembered of her eating the student's ration, of her carelessness with the laundry. On the evening of the day the children return, Granny Lin is asked to leave. Her things are packed and placed at the gate, a duffel bag, not heavy, even for an old woman. The happiness of love is a shooting meteor. The pain of love is the darkness following. A girl is singing to herself in a clear voice as she walks past Granny Lin in the street. She tries to catch up with the girl. The girl moves too fast, and so does the song. Granny Lin puts the duffel bag on the ground and catches her breath, still hanging on to the stainless steel lunch pail with her other hand. All the people in the street seem to know where their legs are taking them. She wonders since when she stopped being one of them. Someone runs past Granny Lynn and pushes her hard on the back. She stumbles and catches a glimpse of a hand before falling down. A man in a black shirt runs into the crowd with her duffel bag. A woman stops and asks, "Are you all right, Granny?" Granny Lynn nods, struggling to recover from the fall. The woman shakes her head and says aloud to the passersby, "What a world! Someone just robbed an old granny." Few people respond. The woman shakes her head again and moves on. Granny Lynn sits on the street and hugs the lunch pail to herself. Hungry as people are, it is strange that nobody ever thinks of robbing an old woman of her lunch. That's why she has never lost anything important. The 3,000 yuan of dismissal compensation is safe in the lunch pail, as are several unopened packages of socks. Colorful, with floral patterns. Souvenirs of her brief love story.
Yiyun Lee's story, Extra, read for us by Lois Smith. This is Selected Shorts, and we're interested in your response to these programs. Please email us at shorts@symphonyspace.org or write to Selected Shorts, care of Symphony Space, 2537 Broadway, New York, New York, 10025. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2007 by Stephen King, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Additional support is given by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund in the New York Community Trust, the Henry Nias Foundation, the Axe Houghton Foundation, the Arthur Foundation, and members of the Symphony Space Literature Producers Circle. Public funds come from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art, and the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.